I'm Rebecca Lavoie, your host for the Undisclosed Addendum, episodes on the Pam Lanier case. You might know me as the audio producer for Undisclosed, but I'm also a journalist by day and the author of several true crime books and host of the podcast Crime Writers On. This week, the Undisclosed team premiered their second episode in the case of Pam Lanier, who was convicted in the 1997 death of her husband, Dorian, in Chincapin, North Carolina. The episode traced Pam's life from childhood through her incarceration, focusing on the harassment and favorable plea bargain she received in the wake of Dorian's death. So joining me this week is Madeline Barron. She's an investigative reporter for APM Reports who has received numerous prestigious national awards for her reporting, including two Sigma Delta Chi Awards, a Gracie Award, a George Foster Peabody Award. Currently, she's the host of one of my favorite podcasts, In the Dark. Season one of In the Dark covered the case of Jacob Wetterling, and season two, which just launched, investigates the case of Curtis Flowers, a man who has been tried six times for a quadruple homicide in Mississippi. Madeline, it is wonderful to talk to you.
It is so great to talk to all of you. We've been so busy reporting. It's great to be able to come up and talk about it.
And Susan Simpson is also with me. She's one of the hosts of Undisclosed and a co-host of the 45th podcast. She's also an attorney and she blogs at theviewfromll2.com. Hello, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
And also with me is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, the blog editor of Evidence Prof Blog, and a law professor and associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and my favorite legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm great. And in no small part, because one of my favorite true crime podcasts of all time is back in my feed, In the Dark. I have talked a lot and written a lot and given interviews in which I have said that In the Dark is one of my all-time favorite podcasts. So, Madeline, the first two episodes dropped this week. We're going to be talking about it next week on Crime Writers On, but I'm wondering for people who haven't maybe heard it yet, what can you tell me about the Curtis Flowers case and what listeners can expect in season two of In the Dark?
Yes, so the second season of In the Dark is about, like you said, the case of Curtis Flowers. So Curtis Flowers is a Black man who's from a small town in Mississippi called Winona. And back in 1996 in Winona, there was a quadruple murder, a bizarre crime at a local furniture store. Four people shot execution style in the head. And after a few months, Curtis Flowers was arrested and charged with that crime. And he was convicted and sentenced to death by an all-white jury in Mississippi. And that is really just, as we say in the podcast, where this story just begins, is with his first conviction. Because Curtis Flowers has gone on to be tried six times for this crime. And the entire time he said he's innocent. So this case has gone on for 21 years. And so what the podcast does is, like, myself and a team of reporters moved to Mississippi for a year to report this case. And we go piece by piece through the state's case against Curtis Flowers. And we look at each piece of significant evidence against him and see what is actually happening in this case. And for us, the story isn't just about Curtis Flowers, which he is facing the possibility of execution. It's also about accountability of prosecutors in this country. That in this case, here's a man who's been tried six times. The prosecutor keeps trying the case again. It's very hard to get a conviction against him to stick, and yet the case keeps going. And Curtis has been in prison or jail the whole time. So you'll hear in the podcast from a lot of people who've never talked before. Also people who have talked about the case but have not said what they're saying to us. And we ended up talking to hundreds of people at least, and we counted. I tried to count up the number of documents that we looked at for this the other day, and I gave up at something like, it's over 300,000 pages. Wow. At this point.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Now, Madeline, you and I are both, you know, public radio, born and bred. You know, I know that you, APM Reports is part of APM, so Minnesota is your home base typically. I know that it's super unusual for any newsroom to send a reporter or team of reporters to embed in a place to report a story. And I also know that this place is very different from the place that you are typically reporting. What has that been like, living and working in Mississippi as you've been digging through this case? Is it better than trying to do it from somewhere else?
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine doing this story without living there. Like, I actually don't even think it would be possible. A lot of the people that we talked to didn't have phones, or they don't really use phones. I mean, a lot of this reporting was done going door to door, very old fashioned, knocking on doors, talking to neighbors. And there's also another important part of the story, too, which is that if we're going to accurately portray a place, we really do need to spend some serious time there. And so I think spending a year allows us to really say some things about the town and how some of the dynamics in the town might have affected the case. But if we hadn't have done that, if we hadn't moved down to Mississippi, I don't see us being able to responsibly draw certain conclusions. So yeah, no, it's been interesting. I mean, we've had not just myself, but a team down there, and, you know, just day in and day out, like going to the courthouse, getting documents, talking to people, knocking on doors full time for a year. So, yeah. Mm.
Now, Susan, this reminds me, you know, when you were doing season 2 of Undisclosed, the Joey Watkins case, the case was out of Rome, Georgia, and you were there all the time. You were going there after work. You were driving there on the weekends. I know you spent time there as a kid. That's actually a case that still gets questions from listeners on social media that, you know, last week when I hosted, I didn't get to those questions. But this week, since you're here, there were questions from Carol Kirchick and Christina Perrone. Both wanted to know what is going on in that case. So can you just do just a quick reminder about that case from Rome, Georgia, and just let us know what's going on with that appeal?
Yeah, and I was actually back in Georgia 2 weeks ago for a hearing in the Joey Watkins case. As you know, at the end of our season 2 series on Joey's case, his attorneys at the Georgia Innocence Project filed a habeas petition on his behalf. That habeas raised 3 main grounds, the first being the holdout juror who had conducted independent testing during jury deliberations, after which she came back and told other jurors about it and ultimately switched her vote to guilty. The second has to do with the dog, the grave dog. Joey, in this case, was accused not just of killing the victim, but also later killing a dog and putting it on the victim's grave. And this was brought up at trial. However, at the trial, the state's expert testified and the prosecutor informed the court that although they'd examined the dog and proven it had been shot, they had never recovered a bullet and never were able to do any testing on that and determine, like, where it may have come from. But in 2016, after Claire had numerous Open Records Act requests, she was able to find some names, people to talk to. And after a series of interviews, people who, you know, gave her more info, and she worked off of that, she finally spoke to a medical examiner who turned out to have a box in the back of his closet with some old files. And one of them was an index sheet showing cases he'd worked on, including one for a dog autopsy that had a case number we'd never seen before. So Claire went back to the GBI with that to request more files, and at that point she was able to obtain records showing that that bullet from the dog had been recovered, and it did not match any weapons that were relevant to the case. And that was something obviously that had never come up before. The third major basis of Joey's current habeas petition has to do with other records obtained from the GBI of a different sort. Those records showed that back in 2000, the start of the investigation, the Floyd County Police Department had actually performed its own drive testing in the case to investigate the cell evidence. Now, that's not something that has ever been disclosed before. It was not disclosed back at the time of trial, and there's no records that have been handed over in response to any of the many Open Records Act requests to the Floyd County Police Department by Claire and GIP. But the GBI records show conclusively that such testing did take place back in 2000. And was never handed over to the defense. So that's what Joey's habeas petition is based on. But all of those things is not actually what the recent hearing in April was about, because this is Joey's second habeas petition. He had a previous one about a decade ago that was turned down. And because it's what's called a successive petition, there has to be a preliminary hearing to determine whether or not Joey is barred from bringing those claims on the grounds that they were not raised in his earlier petition. So the hearing was in Walker County, and the state AG's office represented the state for this, while Claire from GIP and Marietta attorney Ben Goldberg represented Joey. It was a short hearing, I think like 40 minutes maybe. No witnesses, it was just attorneys arguing. And the state's position is that Joey is barred from bringing these claims now, so long after his conviction in 2001, and that Joey had an obligation to find this evidence at the time of his first habeas a decade ago. And because Joey was only able to find this evidence in 2016, those claims can no longer be brought. Joey's attorneys, unsurprisingly, are arguing the opposite, and that this new evidence could not have been reasonably raised in his prior habeas petition. At the end of the hearing, the judge requested further briefing from the parties, and that'll be due in 30 days from the hearing, so I think about May 18th. And at that point, the judge will review, and if the judge rules that Joey will be permitted to continue with his habeas petition, at that point, an evidentiary hearing will be scheduled so that the parties can produce evidence, have witnesses on the stand, and argue the claims in Joey's habeas on the merits. So, yeah, that's where things are now with Joey's case. The next step will be for the parties to finish their briefing on the matters that were raised at the preliminary hearing, and we'll keep y'all updated as the case progresses.
Now, the Pam Lanier, Joey Watkins, and Curtis Flowers cases, they all take place in rural regions, but Undisclosed has also covered cases in urban areas like Philadelphia and Baltimore. And Madeline, you've covered stories in urban areas like the cover-up of clergy sexual abuse in the Twin Cities. I'm curious about everyone's thoughts on the difference between investigating and reporting on cases in rural versus urban areas. Colin, what do you think? Like, what are the differences that you see from where you sit?
Yeah, I mean, for me, what I see in both the Joey Watkins case and the Pam Lanier case, as well as the Ronnie Long case, is that in these rural cases, there are so many rumors going around about everyone involved in the case, the defendant, the victim, the attorneys, the police, and there's so many rabbit holes you can go down. And of course, in the Joey Watkins case, we went down many of those rabbit holes and explored those issues. With the Ronnie Long series and the Pam Lanier series, I sort of streamlined it and focused on the essential issues. But that's the big difference. In cases out of Philadelphia, like the PBVC case, the Terrence Lewis case, a lot of people are reluctant to talk, and it's sort of like pulling teeth. In these rural cases, especially in the South that we've covered, so many people want to talk and they want to tell you about X, Y, and Z for people A, B, and C. And so that's sort of the main big difference that I see.
I would also say a big difference is the amount of time the investigators have. In large cities, even the big cases are more streamlined. They're more efficient. Even a case like Anon's, which is a big, complex case, it has a more very direct, like, boom, 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 get this done, get that done. The cases from rural areas are probably better for podcasts, to be honest, because they are such a mess, a sprawling sort of investigation with detectives who have more time than they might have in a busy jurisdiction. So they can devote it to pet projects, and the investigation can go on in rambling, dysfunctional ways to a much larger degree than a case can in a big metropolis.
For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter the most. I've been reading The Economist since I was 15, and that's because economics has so many intersections with so many issues, including issues surrounding law and crime. Why do prisoners join gangs? How do prosecutors become the kings of the courtroom? Can a lawyer admit the guilt of a client who claims to be innocent? These are some of the articles that recently appeared in The Economist, and I found all of them to be fascinating reads. And The Economist covers so many topics, ranging from politics to the environment to healthcare. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing our world. And now, you can get your free copy of The Economist by visiting economist.com/undisclosed. That's economist.com/undisclosed. Enter your details for a free copy delivered right to your door.
Now, I live in New Hampshire, obviously. Kevin and I have written, between the two of us, 5 true crime books where we, you know, reported extensively on real crimes that happened here, real murders that happened here. I've done a lot of reporting on crime in my day job, in my public radio newsroom. And, you know, I can add something else to this, which, you know, take it in the spirit that I mean it, because in my experience, it's been true that the law enforcement officials and the prosecutors who work on cases here, where especially where they're happening in smaller towns, there's more of like a mission focus to a solution than there is like, this is just part of my job and this is the procedure and I'm getting it done. Like, a lot of the investigators and a lot of the prosecutors in these cases, like, they take it really personally in a way that, you know, growing up in New York, I remember a lot of crime stories. Yeah, sometimes it would get personal, but it's also very much about the business of arresting and prosecuting and running cases through. And I don't know, I think there is more time and care put into it, but there are also a lot more, you know, sort of feelings at stake, you know, emotions at stake, that small town dynamic of wanting to like do right by a community, or just because you're going to see these people in the grocery store next week, be able to tell them something about what you've done. I don't know, Madeline, am I just painting this with too broad a brush here? What do you think?
I mean, I think that there are so many interesting things when these cases are happening in small towns, like what you're saying, but also, you know, that's true for everyone in the case. So if you're on a jury in a town, Winona is a town of about now about 4,000 or 5,000 people. So if you're a juror in this death penalty case in this town, the case of Curtis Flowers, you're going to see all of the people, not just the defendant's family or the victim's families. You're going to see the witnesses. You're going to see law enforcement. You're going to maybe even be distantly related to these people who are involved in the case. So everybody knows something. And as a reporter, when you go into that kind of environment, it's really very different from reporting in a large city because, you know, if you're reporting in like Atlanta or something like that, you know, it's not the case that you don't need to talk to everyone in Atlanta. And you also don't need to talk to everybody on the same block. Usually, you know, like you're going to go track down some witness who now lives on this one street someplace 20 years later. In the case of Curtis Flowers, it was true that we wanted to talk to basically everyone. And it was everywhere we were reporting, even the people we would run into by chance would often end up being key people that we'd want to talk to. You know, I would be talking to one person in his front yard. And this is something that actually happened. The next door neighbors were having like a Sunday afternoon party after church, and they're being kind of loud. And I had to sort of say, well, could you guys sort of keep it down a little bit because we're trying to record? And it turned out that those people were also people I wanted to talk to, but I just didn't realize. And so the whole reporting process was like going from one place to another to another. And you know, even when we were looking for people, you know, we'd knock on the wrong door and it would turn out to actually be someone we wanted to talk to almost more. And so you feel like, and the longer you spend, the deeper you get into it, you sort of come up and think, I think I've talked to like half the town at this point, just in a really convoluted order. You know, I should have just gone block by block.
Or held a meeting.
Right.
But this happens as a reporter, too. I mean, the first book that Kevin and I wrote together, the guy who is still in prison for killing the father of his high school friend, he lived in the town where we live when he was arrested. And this is the town where he grew up and went to high school. So this crime had been a cold case for 20 years. A lot of people in town knew he had done it. No one ever said anything. And that's kind of the story around the book, is like, how can so many people know and no one ever say anything? I interviewed him in prison a bunch of times. There were a lot of people who were involved in the case who went to high school with him, who were part of the prosecution's case, was like splitting up this gang of friends who, you know, had all kept the secret for so long. But now as adults, like the stakes were way higher and they weren't interested in keeping the secret anymore. So the reporting, it was like really fraught because I live in the community with a lot of these people. And there was a lot of talk about what this reporting was going to do to the community. And now flash forward, you know, 8 years since the book came out, I was on a walk this weekend and I like walked by one of the characters in the book and she's just like, oh, hey, we have our dogs. And I'm like, hey, and you just kind of have to at some point reconcile, like, this is a real thing. It happened. I'm a reporter. I reported on it. And we all still live here. Like, it's weird.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is that, you know, in this town where we were reporting for season two of In the Dark, people are very split on how they view the case. And so for the most part, white people in town, much more likely to think Curtis Flowers is guilty. Black people in town, much more likely to think Curtis Flowers is innocent. And so you get very different reactions depending on who you're talking to. You know, some people are very, you know, want you know, to look at this piece of evidence that they think is problematic, or like, go talk to this person. And then other people are kind of just suspicious of why you're even there, you know?
Right.
So it really, I think, too, also depends on who you're talking to. But I think in this case, it has split the town. And it's a small town. And it is a lot to ask people to put up with one trial. You know, the families of the victims, the defendant's family, the defendant, the lawyers, the jurors, the witnesses. But to go through this six times, it's like this collective trauma in this town to have this never be over with.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, it really is. The six is a lot. And I don't think we can overstate that. And by the way, I just want to tell you, I think it's wonderful that how in the first episode of the second season of In the Dark, you just came out and said it, that white people feel differently about this than black people do. I mean, I think that that is, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you're not drawing some like unreasonable conclusion there. But I do think it's something that we hear equivocation about in a lot of reporting around stories like this. And I think it's great that you didn't equivocate. So Good on you for that.
Thanks. I mean, yeah, race plays a very clear role in this case. I mean, that's just the truth of it.
Yeah. Well, there's a thread tying the Curtis Flowers case to the Pam Lanier case, which is the subject of the season of Undisclosed. Now, you talked in the first couple episodes about all these verdicts being thrown out, Madeline, and Curtis's trials. But in the second trial, he was only prosecuted for one of the murders. The court threw out his conviction, though, based on finding the prosecution introduced a bunch of evidence, photographs, slides, autopsy diagrams, regarding the killing of the three other victims as a, quote, tactical scheme. What are your thoughts about the strategy of the prosecution trying that trick?
I mean, my most basic thought is that is a very tricky line to walk, because the murders that were separated out all took place in a store. All of the victims are within a few feet of each other. And so there was there's just practical problems left and right in the trial. You know, can I show this photo? Well, it's going to be a photo that includes the other bodies. And so just trying to separate that out at trial and all of the individual decisions that the judge had to make about what comes in and out, I don't think it was necessarily a surprise to a lot of people watching the case to find out that it did get overturned in part because of that reason. So like the first two trials were individual killings. Like the first trial was for one person who was killed. The second trial was for another. And after that, they tried Curtis for all four together. But it's very hard to separate it out. And like what the defense has said back then is that, you know, the prosecution, this isn't fair. Curtis is being tried for one crime, not for these other three. And the prosecution can't have it both ways, or at least they shouldn't be able to. They shouldn't be able to introduce this other evidence unless they're going to put him on trial for all four. It did get very messy in the trial itself because, you know, with like lengthy motion hearings and all kinds of things like that to try to figure out how do you draw the line. And then ultimately it seemed like it made more sense, according to everybody involved, to try them all together. And so that's what's happened since then.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Colin, can you explain the thread that ties this to the Pam Lanier case and let us know what your thoughts on this are?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically 2/3 of the evidence and testimony in the case has nothing to do with the poisoning death of Doreen Lanier. It is a huge chunk of the trial about the drowning of Johnny Ray, her prior husband, and then a decent amount right from the start of trial about this fire at the Ludie Brown house. And, you know, that gets this problematic issue of character evidence. We want to convict people based upon evidence that they committed this crime they're charged with. And we don't want this trial being dominated by other incidents, especially when, as in this case, there's no evidence of wrongdoing. They had no evidence that Pam had anything to do with the drowning of Johnny Ray. The fire at the Ludie Brown house was deemed accidental. And so for the prosecution to basically buttress their weak case of evidence of her guilt of killing Doreen with this evidence of doctrine of chances, where it's just sort of what are the odds this person has bad luck? Well, people have bad things happen all the time, and that's really what this trial feels like. When a lot of people say about this trial is it's not a trial for the death of Doreen, and that's not why the jury convicted.
What do you think, Susan?
When you don't have much direct evidence proving the crime you're trying to prove, you can just attack the person all day and hope the jury hates them enough they want to go home and convict them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, it's really something. And listening to the way that you've unpacked this case and that you, again, I think really smartly keep playing the deadly women clips to illustrate. Obviously, they were mirroring what the state said and describing this fire as like a huge inferno when it was just basically like a laundry room fire that like singed the back of a sectional. It's really something. It really is. But a huge thing that happened in the Pam Lanier episode this week and another thread tying this case with the Curtis Flowers case is these rejected plea deals. Now, Madeline, you tell us in the podcast that you didn't speak to and aren't going to speak to Curtis Flowers because his lawyers don't advise it, and that's understandable. But according to a Rolling Stone article, in 2010, Curtis Flowers said, "I'm not going to say I killed someone when I didn't. I'd rather be executed and go to heaven and know I did the right thing than be in this world if I have to admit to something I didn't do." Do you know the details of this plea bargain that was offered to Curtis? And do you put weight on the fact that he rejected it?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not even sure if Curtis was offered a plea bargain or what the terms of it might be. Curtis's lawyers from back then say they don't really remember one way or the other. And that and that for his case in general, it really didn't matter because Curtis has insisted that he is innocent. And so in his mind, he's not going to plead guilty, according to several people who've spoken to him. Like you said, I haven't talked to him. I should point out, it's the reason I can't go and meet with him face to face or talk on the phone is because of the Mississippi Department of Corrections. his lawyers don't have advised him not to write letters, but the reason I can't go see him in person is because of the DOC. But yeah, I mean, I think that this is the issue. You know, if you think Curtis Flowers is innocent, well, if you imagine yourself in that situation, would you plead guilty? But I also just don't know what was on the table. I mean, it is a death penalty case. And, you know, he has insisted that he is innocent despite risking execution. I talked to a private investigator who's close to the family, and he told me, you know, similar to what the Rolling Stone piece that you cited said, which is, you know, he's not going to do it. Like, he's very clear on this. You know, I did not commit these crimes and I'm not going to plead guilty. And so, yeah, I wish I could talk to him directly about it. But yeah, I'm curious what other people think about that. I mean, to insist on your innocence for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you'll get two schools of thought on it. You know, you get the one group of people that says, like, every inmate is innocent, right? Everyone claims their innocence. But in my experience, there is a difference between the types of claims of innocence that you hear and the rejection of very, very generous, what appear to be generous plea bargains is a really interesting aspect to this, especially in the Lanier case. I mean, Colin and Susan, the plea bargains in the Pam Lanier case that she could have accepted, one of them was that she could have not admitted to killing Dorian. It would have just said that she didn't do enough to help him medically. So do you think that puts more weight on the fact that she rejected even that one, you know, sort of leaning toward, you know, maybe she really didn't do it? What do you guys think?
It's something you can take into account, but it's not, it's hard to make a sort of one-to-one comparison or just to, it's definitely, I think it matters, yes, and I absolutely look at that when I'm looking at a case, but at the same time, I wouldn't take that on its own to be proof one way or another. And I mostly don't like the reverse, which is like, if someone took a plea, then obviously they're guilty. Because there isn't really a correlation you can draw. On the other hand, for the Lanier case, their increasingly nice offers didn't just like, I mean, it was reeking of desperation. So that could have been grounds for even someone who was guilty to be like, dude, they're desperate here. They're going to do whatever they can. Like, they got nothing. Let's just take it all away.
We did hear Colin from our friend, soap opera star and true crime fan, Allison Sweeney, on Twitter, asking this also about this question. And she wanted to know, do we think the prosecution thought they were going to lose? Is that why they kept making these better offers? I'd love your thoughts on that. And then also following up on what Susan just said.
Yeah, well, starting with Susan's point, I generally agree with Susan that I don't usually put much weight in a person rejecting a plea deal, just as I don't put much weight in them accepting one in terms of proving either innocence or guilt. This case for me is a little bit difficult because we're just putting ourselves in someone's shoes and it's tough to say how much you can extrapolate. But if my wife passed away and I'm accused of killing her through poisoning her, I don't care how favorable the plea deal is. If you're asking me to admit that I poisoned my wife, I'm not going to do it. And I'm not going to take that deal under any circumstances. If you give me the option, I have two young kids who I have to provide for, and you're giving the option of saying, look, all you have to say is you were maybe negligent in not getting her enough medical attention. You can serve 6 months, only serve them on weekends, have work release. I'm signing that in a second. I'm not taking the risk I'm convicted. And so that for me is a little bit different in this case than the typical case. In terms of Allison Sweeney's question, that's interesting. We're going to address this in much more detail in episode 3. I do think that the state thought they were going to lose. I don't necessarily think the defense thought they're going to win. And so that'll play out a bit in episode 3 as to what was going on with these plea deals and why they were being rejected by Pam.
It was interesting. I mean, you have really gotten a lot of great voices in this podcast, including, you know, I don't know if you interviewed her lawyer or if that was someone else's interview tape where he basically says, like, he begged her. He was yelling at her and, like, pounding on the table trying to get her to sign that plea deal. You know, she could have been out in what, like 10 months or something ridiculous like that and not admit anything and not admit guilt to murder. And, you know, he says, like, I absolutely begged her to take the deal. That was really interesting to hear.
Yeah, and that, again, will play out even more in episode 3, where there's some information the defense had that fully explains why they even got aggressive with her and trying to get her to accept the plea deal. And you also understand from her perspective why she wasn't willing to accept it.
Well, we do have some follow-up questions about that we'll get to in the listener question portion of this show. Madeline, 6 trials for Curtis Flowers. It's a record. What do you think it was about this case that made the prosecutor keep bringing it to trial instead of, you know, giving up, cutting bait at some point?
That is a good question. I mean, I think the thing about Curtis Flowers' case is also to take one step back from that and think about, well, why is this even possible? And the only reason that they're in this situation to begin with is that Curtis keeps winning his appeals. And so Curtis wins his appeal, often because the higher court finds prosecutorial misconduct. And then the prosecutor doesn't get taken off the case. The prosecutor is allowed to, again, decide, am I going to try him again or not? And then he tries him again. And then Curtis appeals. And then the conviction gets overturned, sometimes for the exact same reasons as the previous conviction. And the prosecutor just decides to try it again. So the shortest answer is, well, because he can.
Hmm.
Because there's nothing preventing him from doing that. Or at least no court has prevented him from doing that. And it's not double jeopardy because for it to be double jeopardy, Curtis Flowers would have to be acquitted. He's never been acquitted. Right. He's been convicted 4 times and there's been 2 mistrials. So in 6 trials total.
Now, this prosecutor, is he elected, appointed, or hired, this guy?
Elected. He's the DA.
Okay, so he's the DA. So his boss really is the electorate. So it's not like he's been accused of, you know, he's actually not been accused. He's been shown, the courts have said that he committed prosecutorial misconduct with their overturning of these verdicts. And yet his boss is really the people who elected him to office. So it's not like he goes back to an office and he has Arthur Branch sitting there saying, okay, you're not going to be on this case anymore. Like, that's not the way it works, right?
Right. He has, I mean, exactly. His boss are the voters. And when you think about a case like the case of Curtis Flowers, it's really polarized this area of Mississippi. You know, there has been, you know, people are divided. Some people really think the prosecutor, this is exactly what you should do. Of course, you want to try until the end of time. Other people think, you know, 6 trials is enough. If you can't convince a jury after 6 trials in a trial that sticks and that's determined to be fair, then you should stop. And then right now, the latest trial, that conviction has stuck for now, and he's got a post-conviction motion going. At this point.
Now, you also have in the podcast the voice of one of the victim's dads.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really wonderful, you know, how much you've included him in the telling of this story, because I do think it sheds light on some of that motivation. You know, the idea that you have this, you know, devastated dad of this teenage boy who was killed in this murder, who basically admits to you that at one point he plotted the murder of Curtis Flowers to try to get vengeance for the crime. You know, there is something that you could imagine, you know, from a voter's point of view, that is the justice you're trying to satisfy, right? And you hear all these people in your show saying, like, oh, everyone knows he did it. Like, that's enough, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that the prevailing dynamic at play here, that everyone thinks they know he did it? And then plus we have this, you know, victim who is so outspoken and open about his loss. Is that what's at play here, like adding to this, like, fervor to keep this going?
Yeah, and it's really divided. So this district, you know, there are a lot of people who believe that this is the right thing to do, to keep trying it. And like I mentioned earlier, those people are mostly white. And then there are a lot of other people who are mostly black who say, like, no, I think he's innocent. Or even if I don't think he's innocent, I think this should stop, that something's wrong with the system. And, you know, the reality is that this prosecutor has, the DA has, for the most part, run unopposed. So it's sort of a hypothetical question as to, like, would the voters choose someone else? Because for the most part, there hasn't been someone else on the ballot. And, you know, it does seem like there are a lot of people who agree with the prosecutor there, people that disagree, but they have one name on the ballot.
Right. Now, Colin, it's my understanding that a case you've talked about on the show has had the previous record for 5 trials against the same defendant?
Yeah, that is the famous case of Kyles versus Whitley out of New Orleans. That was the case we covered in the Adnan Syed series, where it was 1984. There was a murder in a New Orleans supermarket parking lot, and a man, actually his first name was Curtis too, Curtis Kyles, was convicted in the murder largely based upon the testimony of the Jay Wilds of that case, this guy who went by the name of Beanie. And the prosecutor's office didn't turn over that Beanie had made a Crime Stoppers call, and they hadn't turned over conflicting statements that he had made that undermine his trial testimony. And this was a case where the Supreme Court found a Brady violation. And this was the district attorney's office run by Harry Connick Sr., the father of Harry Connick Jr. in New Orleans. So that was thrown out. They decided, let's take it to trial 2, hung jury. Trial 3, hung jury. trial for hung jury. Finally, it's like 1998, so 14 years after the murder. They go a fifth trial. It's a hung jury again. And finally, at that point, Harry Connick Sr. just decides, I'm not going to get a conviction, and decides to drop the charges and not pursue it. So as far as I can tell, that was the record before Curtis Flowers, was these five trials. The difference being, after that first trial, they didn't get convictions, whereas in Curtis Flowers' case, they keep getting convictions. And then for different reasons, whether it be jury selection or prosecutorial misconduct, those convictions keep getting thrown out.
Yeah, and when you think about what it would mean to you as a defendant, you know, like the case, Colin, that you mentioned with hung juries being tried over and over and over again, your life is completely caught up in that. And so I think people do think that this is a double jeopardy thing. Like, well, you can't have that happen to you. That's like, that's not allowed by the Constitution. So I think people will be surprised, like in the case that you reported on, and then also in the Curtis Flowers case, that, oh no, this is 100% possible if a prosecutor wants to go down this route.
Yeah. Now, in the Lanier case, there was the situation where the initial DA decided not to prosecute, and then a prosecutor named Dean Bowman did take the case to trial. What's the deal with Dean Bowman? Can you tell us about him? And, you know, Susan, I'd love to hear your thoughts, too, and what you think about that, like one prosecutor passing and then another picking it up.
That's not that unusual. I mean, if you usually look to see that in stark contrast, like where one has the same case and says no, the other one says yes. But there's a lot of times you have a case, you get one prosecutor, they might have said no, but it went to another one instead, and they said yes. That's, I mean, it may kind of highlight how arbitrary the prosecutorial power is, but I don't think it's unusual exactly.
So, Colin, what about this Dean Bowman character? What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he's an interesting character, actually. So Mark Rabel at the Wake Forest Innocence and Justice Clinic had another case with Dean Bowman. It's the Daryl Hunt case, which is a famous North Carolina case of wrongful conviction. And there were allegations in that case that Dean Bowman withheld evidence. There's another case in which Dean Bowman was found to have sort of stirred up community unrest in a case where he basically made appeals to the community to try to get this defendant convicted. There was this case where, again, this goes back to the rural versus urban true crime. A lot of rumors about what he might have done in this case and implications and gossip and hearsay. Not too much concrete I want to report on in the podcast or the addendum, but yeah, it's something where it was sort of a game of hot potato where the initial DA thought, I don't have enough to convict, and it was sort of passed around for a while. And even after it got to Bowman, there was some hesitation before finally they found they had enough evidence to take it to trial. But certainly this is a case where a lot of time passed, I think basically about 4 years before this eventually got to trial. And a lot of different points you were thinking this might be over before finally they decided to take this to trial.
Wow. Well, there are a bunch of listener questions this week, and I want to get to a couple of them before we wrap up, because I think some listeners have the same questions that I do about the Lanier case and about some other things, but I want to just step away from the Lanier case for a second. And Susan, yesterday there was a development in Adnan Syed's case, and I'm wondering if you could fill us in on that. A couple of listeners asked about that. The Court of Special Appeals issued something that has kind of triggered a new process here, right?
Sort of. Well, basically what happened is we had the decision come out from COSA 30 days ago, or 30 plus, and it doesn't automatically get ready for appeal or petition for appeal. It's still within that court's power to effect for a certain period of time. And while it's still within that court's power to effect, the prosecution, or if in a different case, like the defense, has an option to move for reconsideration, which is where essentially you go, excuse me, judge, you got this wrong. Can you fix it for me? Which is not that common of a move, because it often doesn't win you any favors with judges. But it could happen. Here, the state has decided not to move for consideration, which means the Court of Special Appeals issued its final thing, saying it's no longer in our hands. It now goes to the Court of Appeals, the highest court, or it goes back to the trial court.
All right. So a question about Pam Lanier's case, and a couple of listeners asked questions along these lines. And I know, Colin, I texted you when I was editing the episode asking you a similar question. So I'm just going to use Brooke's question here to ground this. But there are plenty of other listeners who asked it. And I want to let you know we did get all your tweets. What Brooke asks is, I'm curious about the relationship between the DA and the family of Pam's husband, the ones upset over the land. Him mentioning her land in the deal, I think she means the potential plea deal, was a red flag for me. Do they know each other? It feels like it's about the land, not her husband's supposed murder. Brooke goes on, but that was my question as well, was this land dispute was mentioned in one of these plea deals. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I mentioned the Slayer statutes in the episode, which again are statutes that say if you are found to have killed the decedent and you are set to inherit under their will or to get their life insurance, then you are sort of disinherited because you're the person who's found guilty. And there are some cases, notably one out of New York, in which you had plea deals and the person entered a plea deal and that did not trigger the Slayer statute. So for instance, in North Carolina, the Slayer statute says you're disinherited if you willfully killed the victim. And so in this case, if you look at the plea deal is saying not that Pam Lanier willfully killed Doran, but instead that she was sort of negligent in failing to get a medical attention. And so what that means is that clause were not included in the plea deal, Pam could very well sign that plea deal and then still get the life insurance, inherit the land, etc. So again, sort of rumors about maybe connections between the family and the prosecutor, nothing we can really prove. But my thinking is the prosecutor included that clause because of these other cases out there in which people could still inherit despite entering into plea deals.
All right. So a couple people asked this question as well. This idea of a plea deal of either 6 months or a trial in which the conviction possibility will lead to the death penalty. That seems like a large gap. Some listeners have said it doesn't seem ethical or right, and it also seems like a giant gamble for both sides. What do you guys think about that? Susan, what do you think?
I mean, it's not common, I wouldn't say, but it's something, I mean, it doesn't shock me to hear. I mean, I'm just too jaded at this point. But yeah, obviously, when you put it that way, it's a pretty big swing in possible outcomes, which is often what a plea deal is. Now, in most cases, it's going to be more of like constrained. You're facing like, what, 10 years versus maybe 3 if you plea. But for cases that are sort of high stakes, high rewards, sometimes the prosecutor's going to go, like in this case, okay, I really think they're a murderer. I think they did it. My odds of proving anything aren't that high. But I think they're beyond reasonable doubt guilty. Why not just, you know, take the plea deal and get something out of it, because I'm probably not going to get anything, but it's better to have some justice than none.
Now, Colin, what are we going to hear on episode 3 of this series? You don't have to just give it away.
Something that will horrify the hell out of you. That's all I'm going to say.
Really?
Yeah, and not
really
in the way you're thinking, because I have been so, Colin can attest to my emails going like, oh, God, no, I can't handle this anymore.
It's not another dog incident,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. Okay. But it's
so,
worse.
So you agree with that, Colin?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we've discussed this is 2/3 of the case against Pam Lanier. The other 1/3 are those 2 months between Doran having his bulldozer accident and him passing away from arsenic poisoning. And basically, this episode tests this maxim that comes from Sherlock Holmes. And the question basically is, what happened during those 2 months? What didn't happen? What's possible? What's impossible? And in essence, we try to take you into those 2 months, the last 2 months of Doran's life, and see what was done, what wasn't done, and how it added up to Pam being convicted.
Wow. I'm really looking forward to hearing it. Colin or Susan, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Madeline about In the Dark or anything else about her work?
I feel like anything I asked is going to be like, wait till episode 4 at this point. But it's to me, like listening to the show, I'm like, wow, I can't imagine trying to do a case like this without having the attorneys like on board with it, because it makes your job so much harder.
I wouldn't say the attorneys were not on board with
it. Well, but not letting you talk to him or like, you know, they're not against you, obviously, but they're, you know, they're.
No, we interviewed almost all of Curtis's lawyers, past and present. So the reason we couldn't talk to Curtis in person is entirely on the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
And so his lawyers, we have done extensive interviews with a number of his lawyers going all the way back to, you know, many years ago. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a challenge when you have 6 trials because you have 6 versions. You have so many witnesses and now you have 6 versions of their statements. And then you have all the appeals and then you have all of the pretrial stuff. And so just the scale of it, I think, was one of the biggest challenges to try to even understand. I mean, you know, I would just keep going back and rereading the trial transcripts because, you know, it would be a different, you'd come up with something different or something new that you'd overlooked every time you did it, you know, after 2 weeks of reporting, 4 weeks of reporting, 3 months of reporting, where you would see things that you did not see, even though you read the whole thing, you know, right from the beginning.
Yeah. And I'm probably in the same boat as Susan. There's a lot that I have questions about, but I'm sure you'll be addressing them going forward. I know, though, you've touched upon this a bit elsewhere, but I was curious because, again, this has overlap with the Joy Watkins case and us trying to get the recordings of his trial. I know that recently the judge in the Jacob Wetterling case ordered the release of these files from Stearns County that are not in the FBI's possession. And could you expand upon your thoughts about this decision and its impact to have these documents being released?
Sure. So it was, what happened was the Wetterling family had asked for certain documents to not be made public. And so, and then there were news organizations that fought that. And so the judge decided that these documents, certain documents should be made public. You know, it gets down to the fact that these are public records. And I think it's up to the reporters to really be ethical in how they use material that's in an investigative file. I mean, we've all looked at investigative files. We know how much information is inside those that is not newsworthy. Or that is, you know, maybe it's newsworthy, maybe it's not, but there's a judgment call that has to be made. And there's all kinds of personal information. What I think is significant, though, about having access to these files and what's important about it is that we need to be able to hold law enforcement accountable. And so if we can't see their work, how are we supposed to do that? And if we can't figure out, did they talk to this person or didn't they? Did they, you know, search this street or didn't they? And the only way we're really going to know that for sure is to look at the documents. So I think it's critical that the public has access to those documents. I mean, we think about it a lot in terms of reporters, but it's not just reporters. You know, it's you know, if you were, you know, someone who wanted to know information about the case, you wanted to decide whether to go to the mayor and ask the police chief to be changed or vote against the sheriff or whatever the case may be. Like, you need that raw material to be available to you. But at the same time, I can understand why people would be concerned. You know, there is a lot of personal information. When I reported on the clergy sex abuse scandals, looking at a lot of criminal records in those cases, there's incredibly personal information in those records that as a reporter, I would never make public.
And then the other question I would have is, you noted that Curtis has this upcoming post-conviction hearing. Do you and the team plan to attend that or report on that down the road?
That is still a ways out. So that's going to be quite a ways out before there's any real movement on that. I think that, yeah, we'll have to see what happens. I'm definitely would continue reporting on the case. I mean, for us, in a case like this, I can't imagine not continuing to report on it. We want to see what happens with the case and we want to see where it goes. And I'm so curious to see what people who listen to this podcast will make of this case. Because what has happened so far is that this case is very well known amongst a group of about 5,000 people in North Central Mississippi. And so what will everyone else think?
Now, Madeline, you know, I had the opportunity to see you and your senior producer, Samar, make a great presentation at a podcast conference last summer about sort of your philosophy behind telling these stories. And I'm not going to ask you to, like, summarize the whole presentation, but I found it so compelling. And I know a lot of people who listen to Undisclosed and The Addendum listen to a lot of true crime podcasts and have opinions about a lot of true crime podcasts. As a journalist, I think yours is at the very, very, very top in terms of quality and standards and production value. And I'm just wondering if you could just share a little bit of that philosophy that you guys have underpinning this reporting that you're doing.
I guess I would say that it comes down to, why are we choosing the stories that we're choosing and what are we doing when we're reporting? So for us, when we're thinking about a story to report on, it can't just be an interesting story. It has to be a story that has high stakes, and not just for the people involved, the immediate people involved, but that it tells us something or gets at something that's larger than the individual case. And that's not to say that individual cases shouldn't be covered, because absolutely should. It's just for our team, thinking about, like, in-depth investigative reporting, we're really selective about wanting to cover stories that also get at issues that we think are underexplored, that are relevant to people who are not involved in the case, so have nothing to do with the case. So, like, with Curtis Flowers' case, there's serious issues about the accountability of prosecutors. And, you know, prosecutor has an ability to charge you with a crime, and that's not, you know, that's everywhere in the United States. So that's one thing. And I also think, you know, we just try to be, we're very fortunate that we have such a large reporting team. So we can just take the time to go through everything, which, you know, for Curtis Flowers' case, I can't imagine not having that, because you would be so worried you'd be missing something or something like that if you didn't have a large team. So we're really fortunate in that way. And I also think, you know, it's tricky when you're doing this kind of reporting, because everybody is in pain over these crimes. So you have just a lot of trauma. You have people with complex relationships to the trauma. You don't want to re-traumatize anyone. You also, you know, are there because you believe the public should know about what's going on. And so you really have to be, you just have to be a basic good person in the way that you go about your job, you know? I mean, you just have to, you know, and I think that there's a lot of reporters who do this really well, who I've learned a lot from. So it's just, you know, but it's tricky, you know, when you're in these situations, you feel you're asking a lot of people to dig through some really painful memories. But I think that you do that for a reason. You do that for the goal of telling a story that you believe to be important, and that, you know, the people involved in the story believe to be important as well. But yeah, it is always a lot to ask of someone to go through, you know, what is often the worst day in their life or the worst moments in their life. And I think also being aware of all of the different people that can be traumatized by a story, you know, that it can be the family involved. It can also be law enforcement involved. It can be anybody who's involved in the case, jurors, and trying to tell these details in a way that bring you in closer to the story instead of make it into a spectacle. And so we're always trying to think of, like, how can we connect people to the people in the story in a way that draws them closer instead of, yeah, making it more of, you know, like a car accident where you sort of slow down and peer over.
Well, that was the thing that you guys did that was so wonderful in your talk, is you used the same piece of tape. I think it was a conversation with the neighbor of Jacob Wetterling, who was a suspect for many years, who was ultimately cleared. And you guys played it with some super manipulative, ominous music underneath it. And then you also just played it, and you showed the difference of how, as an editor, you can make something sound worse than it is and be not a nice person. So thank you for being a good guy. We really appreciate it.
Well, you know, journalists have to, we have to be held accountable like everyone else. And so we've got to make the right decisions. And we have, you know, that, like, think one of the things about playing those two versions, it's like it's showing the power that a journalist has. And so you just have to be really aware of that.
I think that's something for all of us to keep in mind as we tell stories and talk about stories. And, you know, as Colin and Susan, you guys know, like, lawyers telling stories need to be accountable too. And I know you guys work really hard at that. So it's really fun to work with you for that reason.
Thanks. And yeah, big fan of In the Dark myself. So certainly, listeners, those of you who didn't listen to season one, I would say go back and check that out. And I can already tell from the first two episodes, Curtis Flowers series, must listen.
I would say too, given, Madeline, I've been thinking a lot about you the last couple weeks with the arrest of the alleged Golden State Killer. Mm-hmm. You know, that huge press conference they gave where they talked about their victories as investigators. And I think back to that first episode of In the Dark season one, and you playing that press conference in the Jacob Wetterling case and breaking down how that's how it goes, you know, and how can you call a 30-year cold case victory when it's really just a failed investigation. So you've brought a lot of things to light that I think give us all a lot to think about when we're listening to these other stories. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I'm so interested in the case, that the Pam Lanier case as well. I was just getting caught up on it earlier today. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Madeline Barron, everyone should listen to In the Dark. We'll just leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
And Susan Simpson, lawyer, co-host of Undisclosed, and always a pleasure to hear your insights. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation.
Thanks, Rebecca. And great to have you back on.
And Colin, thanks so much for doing all the prep for this conversation. It's always wonderful to have a bunch of, like, really thorough, legally accurate notes to work from before I'm getting ready to tape the show. It's always fun to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks again for hosting. We have some new developments in the Pam Lanier case, just talking to some people today, and looking forward to having a resolution to this case at the end of episode four.
Oh, that's a big swing, Colin. Excited to see how that one goes. Undisclosed Addendum is produced by the amazing Hannah McCarthy. Check out her award-winning series on the podcast Outside In. She co-hosted a four-part story called Powerline that everyone should listen to. Thanks to the amazing Methil Telhan for executive production skills. None of this would happen without her work. And for everyone at the Undisclosed team, I'm Rebecca Lavoie. We'll be back next week with more on the Pam Lanier case. Thanks so much for listening.